TLS is go for main engine start.
Go at throttle up. Negative return. Then we see a nominal Miko. Welcome to space.
Oh, happy Thursday, Jake.
Happy Thursday the 13th.
It sure is.
We sure missed that one in this Halloween. We could have had a nice Friday the 13th this October. So close.
We have a spooky guest with us today. Ben Brockert from, are you in Germany right now?
I'm in Berlin, yeah.
Yeah, how's that?
It's
Did you
good.
See that tank? I saw you tweeting about it. There's a tank. There's a Russian tank on display or something.
They got approval for a tank, but they don't actually have the tank yet. They still have to import the broken tank. But yeah, there was an art group who wanted to put a destroyed tank in front of the Russian embassy. And then the neighborhood said no. And then they went to court and court said, oh, you have to let them do that because it's free speech, basically. And so now they still have to get permission to do the rest of it and, like, actually go acquire a busted tank.
They don't even have a beat on which tank they want.
This is paperwork before. Yeah, it's very German.
Wow. It's a real Boca Chica over there for this particular project.
I'm just like, okay, yeah. I guess there's a lot of tanks available, right? That's what I hear, at least.
Yeah, there's a whole military parade worth of them somewhere in Ukraine.
Quite an inventory, yeah.
Yikes. Okay. Ben, we're excited to have you on because you've worked at some companies in the space world, and some that people will know pretty well, some maybe less so, and we're excited to kind of hear your perspective on things because you've seen a lot of different stuff, and we like to kind of talk to interesting people who have been around and had their hands dirty with all the machinations of this space revolution that's happening right now. Right, there's lots of stuff happening behind the scenes, and so
and the list of companies that you've been at, right, like it's pretty evenly split in my brain where it's like half of them I'm like, this confirms that place is awesome because Ben was there. The other half, I'm like, ooh, I got to figure out what was going on at that place that Ben was working for a little bit. It's a pretty even split on the list. So
you got to frame it differently. It's like half the company's good because Ben worked there. Half the company's good because Ben left there.
I felt both of those things about the same company at times too. Yeah. So
that's the circle of life. Well, did you bring a drink from,
I did.
From anywhere your travels have taken you?
I went for Space Connection for one part. I went to Berlin's Rum Depot, and I have a 8-year Barbados rum.
Wow.
And so I have a small glass of that. And then as a backup, because it's important to have a plan B, I have a Berliner Pilsner. So that is my
really prepared
backup drink. Yeah.
Jake size too. That's a nice big one.
It's good.
Yeah. So do you know the space connection for Barbados?
No clue.
It's pretty strange.
About the place Barbados,
like
a
ground
rum?
Station or something.
Yeah.
Better than ground station. There was this Canadian guy, Gerald Bull, who decided that the way to put things into orbit was with a giant cannon. And so he worked on a series of projects, and the most successful one was right next to the airport in Barbados, which was these Navy cannons just like welded together end to end. Yeah, there you go, the HARP space gun. That was very quick. And so this was actually my last trip before COVID. I went there for New Year's and went and looked at the space cannon and actually stood on top of the space cannon, basically. So
I remember you tweeting about that. I just forgot that it's in Barbados because what a weird spot for this thing to be.
It's a weird spot for it. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know why. I think there was some artillery there that they could use. But
fun fact, these people went on to found Spin Launch. It was the same group. same energy,
Yeah, Gerald Bolt, like there should be a movie. Maybe there is a movie, but there should be a movie because after that he then went to a country in the Middle East and offered to make them a giant cannon and then started on the process and then was assassinated by Mossad for building a giant cannon that could have been used for other purposes. So that was the end of Gerald Bolt's space cannon project.
Wow.
a dark ending.
Jeez. Yeah. But yeah, from Barbados,
it was bizarre.
Yeah, it's a strange story. But they successfully fired a thing into space from Barbados, which not into orbit, because it's pretty hard to, you can't really shoot something into orbit from a cannon. Like, you still need rocketry, but yeah. Or a centrifuge for that matter.
Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a strong start right there. The Atlas Obscura stuff right there. That's really good. I like that you took the inspiration from the place name too. It has nothing to do with the rum, the particular rum that you're drinking. Nope. So yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's good. Anthony, what are you drinking?
Well, Jake, for the second show in a row, though nobody knows it yet. More on that later. I'm drinking a Perpetual IPA from Trogues. Nice. We were talking about Pittsburgh right before we went live. I was close to Trogues on my drive to Astrobotic. So I do have some mission patches, by the way. So I'm going to send one to Ben.
Got the swag.
He loves Pittsburgh. Ben's a huge Pittsburgh fan. Ride the Cars and Moon River. He got this thing too. So
I'm just saying, every press release from now on, any company should say, you know, how their, you know, accomplishments for the city of Pittsburgh. Like, it's a good basis.
This is the quickest that I have ever been trolled about anything on this show, and I love it. So it's great. It's a real quick iteration speed.
Yeah, it's good.
What do you got, Jake? Cocktail.
I'm also drinking rum today. So I made a pina colada.
Nice.
From scratch. I had the cream of coconut cream, what you call it, and you know, I had some pineapples in the fridge stuff, so I stuck it in a blender. That's great. It's good stuff.
Quality.
Yeah.
It's Cuban rum, though, not Barbadian. Barbadian, is that the right word?
Barbadouin, right word. I think.
Yeah.
I think it's Barbadouin somehow.
Barbadouin?
Yeah.
All right.
I could be making that up, though.
Yeah, somebody fact check the denominims. Denominims? I can't pronounce anything.
I think it's demonym, but I don't know.
Denominator. I went denominator in my brain. We have nothing to pronounce correctly today. So with that.
The denominim, the Barbados denominim is Barbudian.
Oh, man. Well, where do we start on Ben's story time? Give us a little overview of what you're doing now, because it's mysterious to me. You're just traveling around Europe and you're doing some sort of advising, I'm sure, of companies based on your long history of experience that we can then delve into.
Yeah. So right now, I'm in the process of getting a visa to stay in Germany for the long term. I was living in Cyprus until March. Basically, I spent most of the pandemic there. It's pretty easy to get a long-term visa there, and it's a nice warm country to spend a sort of fake retirement, middle-aged retirement. I don't know. I've wanted to move to Berlin for quite some time. So I'm in the process of getting a visa. And yeah, as you suggested, I'm doing some contract work for some companies that are working on, you know, space launch stuff, basically. So hopefully I have an apartment here, and a lot of the travel this year is because, you know, in the Schengen area, you can only spend 90 days in any 180 days, basically. So I was doing about half time in Germany and then half time elsewhere. So I've traveled around an excessive amount so far this year to be able to support that, a lot into the Balkans, basically, and actually spent most of August in Colombia, which was pretty nice. Had some excellent coffee and excellent weather. So I'd never been there before. So it was really good. And then been back to the U.S. and actually went to Iceland twice, which was kind of excessive, very expensive, but went and saw the volcano.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're volcano chasing.
Yeah. It erupted once, you know, a year ago, and then it stopped, and then it erupted again. And I was like, this time I'm not going to miss it. So I spent an absurd amount of money to get tickets and like a $600 rental car for like 2 days to be able to go see the volcano this time. And then
that's basically the same thing we have here in the US right now, though. So don't be too sad about that.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's nuts everywhere. Yeah. So doing contracting and then we'll probably be traveling a little bit more, and then hopefully sort of long-term stabilizing here in Berlin, which is one of my favorite cities in the world.
Have you gotten to know any of, there's, I feel like you are near some of this weird small launch startup kind of thing that's happening in Europe right now, like geographically. Have you gotten to know anyone over there, and what the hell's going on with it? This is the one I'm like, I have not yet to talk to anyone involved with it, but does it seem cool? Does it seem like they got something going on there?
I mean, it's a mix. Like, it seems like there's definitely a lot of the sort of companies with like big schemes. And you know, there's the Arca Spaces and that sort of stuff going on as well. But there's there's definitely legit companies that are doing real things. And it is kind of hard to tell just over online, you know, who actually has hardware and who doesn't, sort of thing. But I have not yet visited there's RFA and there's ISAR, are the two big German ones, and I would like to go visit them. So I need to like make contact with them and go talk to them. There are complications with doing, like, if, you know, it was tempting to go just try to get a job with one of them, but there's complications with that around, as a US person on both sides of it, to be able to do that sort of work. So. Yeah, there's both ITAR, and you know, it's considered defense services, and you have to do all this stuff. So but it would still be cool to go tour them and see what's going on. And there actually are, I've seen a few articles about SpaceXers that have joined some European companies, so it's clearly possible. But I also kind of wanted a break from, you know, small sat launch for just for a little while.
All right, well then why is that? Let's get into it.
I just quickly run through it from the beginning. Like, I grew up in Iowa, went to Iowa State, was working about half time and going to school, and then ended up dropping out because I decided it was going to take forever to actually graduate. So I was going for computer engineering, bought a van, packed it up, drove to Mojave, lived in a van in Mojave for like 6 months, pestering rocket companies until somebody gave me a job, which was Masten Space Systems. And so at that point, Masten had started
too quick. You're going too quick. I need to hear more about that particular time, because that sounds kind of amazing. How big was the van? Where did you park it? Were you near?
It was a 17 passenger van. So like, you know, one of the really big vans, but it only had like one bench seat in it, because if you have all the seats in it, then you're supposed to have a specific license to be able to drive it. But the back was actually full of my stuff. So I just had like the front and the bench. And, you know, basically slept on the bench seat. And there was there's an RV park there. So I would go there to, you know, sometimes would stay there, you know, use the showers and stuff. And then sometimes it was basically just like at a dirt lot, you know, in Mojave, basically. So it was not a great time. It engendered patience. I listened to a lot of NPR. Like, there was you really get used to the schedules of this American life and like what is on at a given time, sort of thing. But and then managed to get a library card at the library, and so then did a lot of reading. And then it was a long time. I pestered X-Corps. They were building the X-Racer at that point, and I actually filmed the first test flight of it, like standing at the fence outside of the airport, which was, you know, seeing the first flight of a rocket plane is kind of cool. And then also talked to Scaled Composites, and they actually offered me a job, but it was at the same time that Masten did, and I was more interested in the rocket stuff than the airplane stuff. So, yeah. But Masten had been four people, and then two people left, and so it was just Dave Masten and John Goff, and so then they were having to rehire again, and I just was purely lucky that I was there at the right time and sort of started as a technician and then gradually took over more and more stuff and ended up running flight test programs and engine test program and doing project management and that sort of thing. Ian Garcia started at the same time as me. He was the GNC engineer. I'm still convinced the best GNC engineer in the world, because like he could single-handedly, you know, build a hovering rocket by himself, sort of thing, in terms of software, which, you know, he later went to another, you know, talked to another team that was doing it, and it was like 20 people doing basically what he had been doing by himself. So very capable, but that was an interesting period in Mojave, definitely.
Yeah, that must have been a really fun time there, because there was like, it was, I mean, still kind of like that in Mojave today, where it kind of has this like dusty pioneer startup feel, you know, where it's just like out of the middle of nowhere. I think it must have been interesting just to be, especially at the ground for something like Masten, which has a interesting story that followed that, right? So.
Yeah. It was, I think it seems a little bit like that sort of plucky Masten rocket company phase has gone away. Like now, I mean, there's obviously still are companies that do testing out there, but at that time there was Mastin and Xcore, which were both, you know, small, doing really interesting stuff. And then there mm-hmm. are a couple other small companies doing just really strange things with rockets out there. And some of that had evolved out of Rotary Rocket, which was like the original, like, weird new space, you know, space launch company.
And, that is such an era that it's just like, I don't know, let's try some weird stuff. Rotary Rocket, that exactly. sounds good. Like, let's yeah. just do something really bizarre.
It's like very much a synergy orange rocket, I think.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. Yeah, they raised like 20, 25 or $30 million for Rotary Rocket too. So like it was one of the first successes in like, oh, you can actually raise money to do this stuff too. So, which yeah, yeah. it didn't go anywhere, but that is also pretty common to the story. but yeah, so yeah, joined Mastin and it was small. They were doing a 4-engine rocket at the time. And then a bunch of things happened. We ended up sort of rebuilding it into the single engine rocket Zombie and then doing the Lunar Lander Challenge. So there were two levels of that and building a whole new vehicle Zoe to do the other level for that. And won the Lunar Lander competition, which is a NASA Centennial Challenge, which was like, you know, $1 million prize. And then, after that, did the first in-air relight of a liquid bipropellant rocket of, you know, taking off, shutting off the engine, coasting a little bit, turning it back on and landing, which was a very short flight, but basically nobody had ever done that before. And it got forwarded around the industry a bit. And at that point, SpaceX was still trying to do parachutes for their first stage. So, you know, who knows what inspired. I do know that Elon emailed it out to most of SpaceX to point out the video of our thing doing it. So maybe inspired some people to think more seriously about doing VTVL there instead of just doing parachutes, which has worked out for him, which is great.
The Lunar Lander Challenge, I wanted to hear about a little bit, because it sounds like a thing that would exist today still. And I also hear that there was a very interesting night before the Lunar Lander Challenge.
Yeah, there were the bigger one for Zoe. Essentially, the challenge itself, you would have to take off and then have a total flight time of 180 seconds and translate 50 meters. And the 180 seconds is basically that anytime you're hovering on Earth, you're expending the acceleration equal to gravity, you know, of roughly 10 meters per second. So 180 seconds of hover is approximately 1800 meters per second of delta V, which is approximately the same as going from low lunar orbit to the surface. So essentially, if you can build a rocket that can hover for 3 minutes on Earth, that same rocket around the moon could go from the orbit to the surface, basically. And so that's what set that requirement. And then just another, just to make it operationally like a pain in the ass complication to it, they also made it so that you had to do that twice within 2 hours, basically. So like you would do a flight and then have to dump all the helium out and make sure it's completely empty of propellants and then refill it completely and repressurize it and then do the same flight back, you know, in the opposite direction within 2 hours, which turns out to have been useful over time, just in terms of like it gave me a reference of like how quickly you can do rocket operations and, you know, really be efficient about stuff. But
it's funny how common that like do it twice thing, like that became a little bit of a scheme for these projects, right?
It's a popular story.
The space plane was like the same thing, right?
Yeah. The space plane, the DARPA launch challenge thing, like they all do that, like do two things in an indeterminate amount of time. Yeah.
Yeah. But one flight we did, what was it? Yeah, now I can't actually remember what it was that was leaked. It was a quickly put together vehicle. It had a composite tank, and the composite tank had a leak in it, so it was dripping fuel down. And basically, it was dripping fuel, which was fine when it was flying, but then it would land, and then it would drip fuel, and then the fuel would catch fire, and the vehicle would burn, basically. And so that's what it did on this one flight one day. And so it burnt off, burnt off a bunch of wires and burnt off a bunch of insulation and the tanks and everything, and you know, all the structure was totally fine. And actually the avionics were generally okay because they're inside of a box, but a lot of the harnessing, which is pretty simple for a pressure fed little rocket, is, you know, but it was all burnt up. And so we were completely exhausted at that point. But a few people had come in off of a mailing list off of the internet, basically. Like some people had just showed up, Keith Stormo and some other, you know, some friends from Mojave had just sort of shown up, and essentially rebuilt the vehicle overnight, like rewired all the harnessing, took a trash can lid, like a Rubbermaid trash can lid, and took some of the struts out. It had like a triangular struts between the fuel tank on top and the LOX tank on the bottom. So they took some struts out and they stuck this trash can lid in, and then they, you know, red RTV'd plumbing fitting to it, a quarter inch plumbing fitting to it, and then ran the quarter inch tube down the leg so that the fuel tank is still leaking the entire time it's flying, but the fuel is, instead of dripping down on the LOX tank and then dripping down on the engine and then bursting into flame, all the fuel is leaking down the leg as this little, like, little piddle off the leg as the thing is flying around, and you can actually see these drips coming off of it while it's flying. And so that was successful.
What flight was this? I gotta pull this up.
Yeah, this is the Zoe, or if you look at just Mastin level 2, winning flight or something like that, you might be able to see, might be able to see some of it. And actually, I still have videos. Like, I never edited the videos because we were so exhausted by everything. So the actual company videos, never really, nothing happened with them, which is a pity. So maybe for like the 15th anniversary, we should edit together a new clip show or something.
When you said I still have that, I was really hoping you were going to finish that sentence with the garbage can Rubbermaid lid.
Can lid.
I still have the trash can lid. It's actually in my storage unit. Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Is this the one? Let's see. Is this it?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's Zoe. It's a fuel tank on the top and a LOX tank on the bottom, and then two helium tanks on either side. And then a single LOX isopropyl alcohol engine. And from this view, you probably can't see it, but there is a little quarter inch line that's running down one of those legs that's just zip tied on, that a slow drip of fuel is just dribbling out basically while it's flying.
That's incredible.
And so, yeah, I mean, the translation is only 50 meters, and they made us build a fake moon landing pad or moon surface, basically, which the I just essentially handed it over to a local concrete contractor and gave him the print, and he went nuts on it. Like, I think it was the most fun that concrete guy had ever had, because he's like, generally people just want to, pour patios or, carport foundations. And instead I'm like, here's a diagram of a moon base with like craters and boulders and stuff. Can you build this for us? And he did a great job on it. So it was really good.
And now that's his patio.
Yeah. And that's probably still out there in Mojave. I don't know if they ever tore that up, but it's also funny because they, each competition had to have one of those. So there's one of those out at FAR, and there's one of those out at Spaceport America as well. So there's three identical little moon pads, scattered around the western United States.
It's like the ghost of early new space. These little lunar lander challenge bits.
Oh, so there's the flyer. Yeah. So yeah.
So this is the one without the trash can lid, I guess.
Yeah, that was the one where there was fire. Yeah. So yeah, it wasn't a huge fire, but it was enough to screw up the harnessing and everything, basically. So yeah, I went home and then came back in at like 3 o'clock in the morning and checked in on things, and then went back home again and went back to sleep. But a group of people stayed up overnight and rebuilt redid the harnessing and had it back together, and essentially put aluminum foil tape over all the burn marks so it looked like it was, correct, basically. And then we went out and we flew it, and we did the two more flights, and we won the competition, which was super, super cool. Yeah. And it was also pretty crazy because, there's definitely a different perspective around operations around rockets, because, like, I was standing like 100 feet away from this thing while I was going. So, like, it's very much not the, the rocket is 2 miles away sort of process. It's like literally we go and we work on it by hands. During the reassembly, one of John's favorite parts of it was that, not the story is his favorite, not the event, but they put together one of the solenoid valves incorrectly. There's a solenoid valve has a coil of copper that opens a little, piston inside of a valve. And so they put it together and they put a washer in the wrong place, basically, so the valve wouldn't work. And so that was the igniter valve. So we refueled, we fueled the thing, and we're on the clock and we go to start it, but the thing won't work. And so with the thing like full of propellant and full of helium and Ian sitting on the control ready to hit the button, I ran in and like sat under the rocket and took apart the solenoid valve and put the solenoid valve back together, and then got 50 feet away and yelled at Ian to push the button so that, and then the thing launches off and, successfully does that part of the launch. So Yeah.
Inside the Richard Garriott kill zone right there. That's for sure.
Yeah. Firmly.
Yeah, it was it was kind of amazing because, like, even it was odd because it was like, rather than like the FAA being like, no, you have to be further away to be safe, they actually like, they put in our flight requirements that people had to be diagonal opposite so that if it flew out that they could, the person could push the button to shut it down and crash it, sort of thing. Like, they required us to have spotters that were only like 150 feet away. So it, yeah, it's sort of a very different situation. But, you know, the whole rocket is like, you know, like 1,000 pounds. So, like, you know, full propellant. So it's not like, you know, it's obviously not a Falcon 9 sort of thing, but still, yeah. It's, you know, there's you some energy there.
You couldn't take it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't
you still don't
it.
Want that to hit you. Or
yeah, that's, definitely not. You know,
it's still undesirable to have that land on you.
Yeah. Yeah, the helium tanks are probably about the most hazardous because they can, you know, if you cut the end off, then they can go shooting off, you know, from the stored inside. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, thankfully that didn't happen.
So you left Maston.
Yeah. And then, so then I actually... we did the in-air relight and then kind of lost direction. Like, it seemed like we weren't going to, the original company plan was to do suborbital reusable, where you'd launch stuff to 100 kilometers and bring it back. And like the thing that Blue Origin is doing now, but yeah, there's the relight. But, yeah, so then I actually always wanted to work with Armadillo, which was in fact the direct competitor. And so ended up going and doing that. And so, there we actually did more altitude stuff. We launched, a reusable or a meant to be reusable rocket to over 90 kilometers. It was not reused because it came back very, very quickly, about, you know, 400, I forget the units now, very fast, just high subsonic. It impacted. I had 7 camera HD cameras on it and I was able to recover one SD card off of it basically. But, but it was an interesting time. There was, yeah, we worked on Rocket Racing League, you know, sort of rocket planes and, a variety of different, yeah. So there were mods and tube rockets, and one got named Stig after the character in the British TV show, basically. And then people thought it was an acronym, and then it ended up being that one. Another one was Stig A, and then another one was Stig B, basically. But So there, I actually did all the video stuff. I actually designed this launch setup basically. So, but yeah, this is the one camera view that survived.
Is that
which
a moon
is,
pad?
That is, yeah. It was launching from the same space in this is in Spaceport America.
I love
so there's
see
a
it.
there's a plain one, and then there's one with moon rocks and craters on it. And then that's the our mission control right there. So again, pretty close. And it actually landed behind us, so it actually flew completely over us and crashed into the desert behind us.
That's
which,
always comforting.
Yeah.
I'm curious, when you say that when you left Maston, you felt like you kind of got off track of where you were heading with, you know, that sort of reusability. And is that why you went to Armadillo, that was the direction they were heading and you felt like that was the right way?
I mean, it's an excellent question. It's hard to totally say at this point because it's been 10 years, you know, exactly what my reason. I'd known about Armadillo for many years and had, you know, knew them at conferences and stuff and had wanted to work there for some time, basically. So part of it was just that, like, I wanted to work there. And it was an odd group because they started as a sort of a hobby group and they would work on Tuesdays and Saturdays and then they turned into a company. And so they didn't really ever hire anybody that wasn't outside the group. So it was partly just an accomplishment to be like, now I've, you know, actually got hired by this group of people. But yeah, they were definitely more focused on actually doing the suborbital reusable stuff, which was interesting to do. And it also, you know, gave me opportunity to do some other things. So I built a 4,000-pound LOX methane engine for NASA there for the Project Morpheus, which was really interesting to do. And then, lots more rocket operations. Actually, like, worse weather, which is kind of impressive. Like, you go from Mojave, but, you know, the cliche of it's a dry heat is actually true, whereas you get into, like, Dallas, and it's, like, 100 degrees 100 days out of the year, and it's also, like, you know, you occasionally get that Gulf humidity up there as well. So, like, that, you know, that does make a difference. But
I didn't know you were on, like, Morpheus.
Armadillo was the contractor to do the, like, actually they sold them one of their original four tank vehicles, Pixel. I think it was Pixel. There was Pixel and Texel. I don't remember which one they sold, but they sold them one, and then they actually ended up using the same sort of sort of platform to build Project Morpheus. And so Armadillo actually built the whole first one, and then later they built it after that one crashed. They built another one through a different process, but yeah. But yeah,
which
they
I
would
recently realized is hanging in Johnson Space Center.
Oh, interesting.
I totally missed that the last time I was there, I think. But I think it's just in the hanging from the ceiling in the main part of the visitor center, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, actually, I hardly ran into Pixel sitting in one of the hangars at the shuttle landing facility. Like, I don't really know how it ended up there. But yeah, I was working there on other things, and then suddenly this old Armadillo rocket was sitting there as well.
I think that's where they did the flight tests, was at the end of the runway they built. They probably got the same concrete guy from Mojave. They flew him in, and he built one at the end of the runway.
Yeah, those are pretty funny. They built a much bigger sort of fake moon pad there.
Used
a lot of like loose gravel, so all those flights there would just be a giant cloud of dust that comes up every time. But it was a fascinating process.
So you went from there, if I'm remembering my history correctly, you ran your own thing for a little bit.
Yeah, so then I went to Colorado.
I'm very interested in next, which is Moon Express, but let's save that for a minute.
Colorado had a company called Able Space with an E, so different name.
This is like before the startups started dropping their letters off the end.
Exactly, yeah. Did contracting there. I worked a bit with John Goff again. He had started up a company called Altius Space Machines. So I did some contract work with him, and then as well as another company in Mojave. Actually did one with Garvey. It used to be Garvey Spacecraft Corporation. I helped them build their first gimbaled rocket engine, basically, and did a few other just sort of random projects, and ended up overextending myself on one of them, and basically just running out of money. So then I was at a conference and I was dead broke, and I ran into Bob Richards, and Bob Richards was like, "Hey, I'll hire you." And I was like, "Okay." So yeah,
that was the vetting process. So it was okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So that is how I ended up at Moon Express. Yes. Went to Alabama, where they had their propulsion test stuff. Tim Pickens was involved at the time, which you might know that name from Spaceship One. He was the nitrous hybrid guy for Spaceship One, basically. But he was involved with Moon Express at that point. And so we had an engine test stand right next to a like fundamentalist church. So like we'd be working through the weekend, had this super unstable, like 1,000-pound thrust engine that just screeched like a banshee. And it'd be like 11 o'clock on a Sunday, and we'd fire this thing and make massive screeching noises. And I always really wanted to just go to the church one day just to sit in on the service and see what they said when this rocket engine went off next door, because they never complained, but like there was no way they didn't hear it, because it was, super unstable. Like,
into the whole thing, a sign from outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were working on the main engines, I guess, for the Moon Express landers. What was your scope of work with that?
That was actually a side project. That particular engine was a side project that Moon Express was doing, basically. But I was most of my time ended up there. They were working on the Google Lunar X Prize, and the GLXP decided to do these milestone prizes, basically, as a way to like essentially just give some of the prize out. And so they set it up so that teams could do whatever they wanted. They just had to say what they were going to do and then do it. So like more sensible teams, like the Indian team, said like, "We're going to build and test a landing gear." And so they built one landing gear and they did one drop test and they got $1 million. Whereas Moon Express said, "Well, we're going to build a full, flight test vehicle, like an analog, flight test vehicle." So I basically did an all-nighter and designed a test vehicle that was an approximation of what the actual lander was supposed to look like. And in the course of took 4 months to go from like concept to the first hold down test, essentially. So like a really fast, throwing it together. So it was a peroxide monopropellant because we had that engine on hand already. And then it had 12 nitrogen cold gas thrusters to do attitude control. and like 5,000 PSI nitrogen tanks to actually run that system, which is pretty scary. And then we did flight testing on that, which didn't go fantastically. They used a cell phone IMU chip, which they selected by which one was the quietest sitting on the bench, which turns out to not be the most useful aspect of an IMU chip. And it turns out that when that one had a rocket engine firing under it, all the data would go to crap, and so it couldn't actually fly the vehicle anymore. There we go.
Is this the one?
Probably, yeah.
December 2014.
But it turns out that if you align the engine precisely enough and put a bunch of weight around the outside to have a really high inertia matrix, then with no control, it will look like you're hovering for a short amount of time. So, yeah.
Oh, I love, by the way, real quick, I love how iMovie the beginning of this video is. It is so iMovie
from 2014. It is absolutely iMovie, yeah.
The last time Orion flew, you were doing this.
Yeah, so I designed that cluster of stuff, and
there it is. There's a lot of late nights. That's just that one guy from Mojave. So
it was
your tenure at Moon Express was what, from around this era to a couple years later? How long were you there for? Oh, Buzz was there.
I was there for about 2 years. Yeah. So it was before this, through this program, and then sort of nothing was happening, but we were at LC-36, and then I left after that.
Yeah. I'm just, I'm curious, like, how you, now with distance and from both your time there, but also Moon Express doing anything, like, was there a particular moment when it went
what
from,
happened, man?
Yeah,
what
like
happened?
I just want to know what happened. Like, it went from you doing this to just like, you know, visualizations, yeah. I guess, and like hype, but no content.
There was actually like a full, so there were the company ended up sort of spread out. There was a propulsion group in Huntsville, and then all this stuff was happening in Florida. And then we had LC-36 in Florida, which we were just using as office space. And then there was like the core sort of software and avionics and stuff was in the Bay Area. And there was a sort of a mutiny, I suppose, where one of the guys in the Bay Area group went to the investors and tried to get Bob Richards fired for basically the same questions of like, what are we doing? Why are we doing any of this? And that didn't go very well. And so it's really, really difficult to get the CEO of a startup fired. And so he ended up like, Bob ended up basically firing most of the company at that point. And so it was down to a small number of people. And yeah, it went very much into just like, we're doing concepts and stuff. Yeah.
Keeping up appearances is kind of the mode that you get into at that point.
Yeah, but the guy who attempted the mutiny, he his theory was that, yeah, that just like, I don't know. Yeah, it was always hard to tell exactly like what was real and what wasn't. I had never thought that the GLXP was super winnable. And so I got to go build another vehicle and show that you could do fast, you know, hardware development in the span of a few months sort of thing, which I think is interesting to do. But I think ultimately, like, I didn't go into it expecting us to land on the moon, and I didn't leave expecting them to land on the moon, basically.
Yeah.
Is that what you do? Is that your thing? Like, I'm going into this company, and you have a particular personal mission statement, and then, like, I'm going to build hardware very quickly, quicker than they think I can, and, you know, deal with this shitty IMU and make it look like we're hovering, and then peace, I'm going to find another thing that's a fun project.
I mean, I'm highly motivated to like doing new things. Like, certainly just repeating something I've done in the past is not very interesting for me. I did that because I needed a job, basically. That wasn't a great example of like, the process of job hunting, certainly. But but I met cool people. Like, there's still people who, you know, I worked with there that I still talk with. So, and that is always one of the high points of at every place that I've been at, is that there's, you know, ends up you make make, you know, if you end up working long nights with people, you're going to end up either, you know, friends with them or never wanting to talk with them ever again by the end of the project, yeah, basically. Yeah. And there's usually some of both at every company. So,
yeah, for sure. But,
Okay.
Astra, it's the only one we haven't talked about yet, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm looking at the list here. Astra,
it's pretty modern. It, right? This one's pretty modern.
Yeah, after MoonX, went and traveled around for 6 months, which, I don't know. I've generally had the theory that, like, the idea of, like, working your whole life and then retiring when you're old, if you survive that long, it doesn't seem like the greatest idea. So, and, you know, there's claims that, like, if you have holes in your resume that, like, it'll be make it hard to get hired. But I think if you, especially in a community like this where, you know, you get known as, you know, someone who gets things done or you don't, basically, like, you know, it's a different situation. Like, if I was trying to work for Fortune 500s, I'm sure it would be different. But basically taking breaks between companies has never been an issue. So for anybody else thinking of doing that, like, go take a vacation between jobs. Like, if you get a job offer, say, oh, I can start in a month, and then quit your job that day and then take a month off.
Co-signed so hard. The part that usually makes you survive that long is something I constantly think about, that, like,
the global arc of, like, planning. Like, I have a 401k, but, like, the expectation that is going to be all totally normal and that I'm going to, you know, in 20 or 30 years, like, that's an ambitious projection.
I just think about, like, we do, as is a segment of the show, Anthony Reviews the National Parks. We do these trips, right? And something we talk about a lot is, like, I don't want to do these trips when I have bad knees. Like, I want to do these when I can still do that hike. I can still climb that set of stairs. I can still climb that mat. Like, I got good knees for a little bit of time. You know, I've got bad knees in my family. Yeah. I don't want to waste them, waste the good ones.
I will say that Joshua Tree has some excellent lava tunnels in it. But
all right, maybe I didn't go in the lava tunnels. Jesus. I did go in the cool, I should pull up a picture, the Hall of Horrors. It's got a really cool, like, little tiny, you know, you can go right between these two rocks. That part was very cool. The rest of it was terrible. So, yeah.
I mean, it is a desert. So, anyway.
You were at took Astra some time for off. Very long.
Went to Astra. I had the same start date as the CEO, technically. Astra was, like, originally there was a company called Ventions. And so all the Ventions people predate me. And that is the CTO and a group of, like, six or seven guys. Me and Chris Kemp actually both have technically the same start date at Astra when it transitioned from being Ventions to Astra. So I was one of the first employees there and was there for 4 years, essentially, and started in propulsion test and then ended up running, was the director of all tests for the company through Rocket One. And then from there was a little bit, I really didn't want to ever go back to Kodiak again because I... Essentially, we shipped a rocket that wasn't ready, and then I spent, like, months and months just sort of grinding away at problems there, which wasn't great. And ended up doing sort of figuring out a new way to do tests and launch automation, and we actually got it to the point where running, like, 35 different test stands and having... you know, a relatively small software team able to support this huge architecture of stuff, and then being able to use the same sort of software processes to be able to write automations for both, you know, any sort of test stand from, like, oh, I want to test a battery, to, I want to test an igniter, I want to test a pump, to, you know, actually doing the full launch automation.
So that was the motivating factor, was I hate Kodiak so much, I'm never flying back here, so let's automate my way out of this job.
Well, that works. That wasn't, but yeah, that works definitely. Yeah.
That's how you said it.
Yeah. It was more. Yeah. I don't know. At a few companies, it seems like I eventually just get to a point where I sort of go wherever the most interesting problem is. And it turned it out to be launch automation. Like I wrote all of the launch procedures for the rocket, and they still read things that I wrote, and I still cringe listening to them on the comms, basically. But
like, I never meant that to live that long.
Exactly.
That's funny.
So it was there, and then that was an interesting experience. It is an interesting company.
You're in a rough spot at the moment. Yeah,
they're in a rough spot. I'm curious to know what you think about the whole, like, going public thing for these kind of companies, because, like, you seem to have a lot of experience for these style of these like small sort of scrappy getting things started. And a bunch of them are just like going straight into the stock market right now. And we're like, I don't know, Anthony and I talk about this all the time. It's just like, I don't know if that's right for them yet. Like, I don't think they have the, I don't know, like Wall Street has got just regular investors. There's just like people saving for their retirement out there. These are not,
it's,
you
Ben's
know,
it's 401k. Not some, it's why he's not
Ben's
planning 401k on this.
Out there. It's just not some special place where a bunch of investors are understand what, how these companies work. And I don't know, I'd love to hear your perspective on that at Astra and anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, the SPAC stuff is almost certainly in many cases kind of a scam, because there is the person who organizes it, who their entire motivation is to find a company and line their valuation up to the point of what the SPAC has, you know, and say like, okay, this company is worth this much, we're giving them the money, then they'll be public. And so they're just motivated to close out the deal, because if they don't close out the deal, they lose a bunch of money. Like that is how the SPACs are set up, is that the person who organizes it only makes money if they actually follow through the whole process. Whereas everyone who put money into the SPAC, like they only make money if like it's actually a good company. And it almost never is. Like it's almost,
and if they want they can get their $10 back before the transaction closes, which is another aspect.
Yeah. And I shouldn't say that it's not a good company. It would be more accurate to say that the valuations are almost always wrong, like that they always have to be overinflated to hit the numbers. So for some companies, like essentially they have lost the ability to raise money. Like they can't raise any more money. They're going to go under. And then the SPAC boom came along at just the right time. And so they were able to do the SPAC exit, which created a bunch of new problems, because now they're a public company and they have to do all of the stuff associated with that, like all the documentation and everything to be actually a public company. But it means that they got an injection of cash that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise, basically. Like, so there are certainly even within the space SPAC stuff, like I know there's SPACs in electric cars and eVTOL and all the other sort of areas of hot technology right now. But there's definitely quite a few companies that had completely stopped getting calls returned from VCs, and then that whole SPAC thing came along at exactly the right time.
It's predatory loans, but for companies.
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, not to talk too much hot shit about your most recent employer, but I was thinking about this the other day, and they bought Apollo Fusion on mostly stock, right? And then the stock's at like 62 cents now. So, you know, I don't know what the funding history was of Apollo Fusion, but if everything went, like they hit all the milestones of all the things, they could have gotten like $45 million of cash. And then the rest of it, another $100 million was in stock that is now likely not going to be on the stock exchange in a year. And so like taking it, exit when it's, you know, easy money and it's the only money available for you in that life cycle point. But then like, can you then immediately trade on that for an acquisition and not actually care long term? And then weirdly, like that's the only thing that might save Astra from being delisted, if they can convince people that they have enough of a future pipeline of engine sales from Apollo Fusion. It's a real weird flow chart that you start drawing out.
Yeah. Which Rocket Lab did it much better, because Rocket Lab took the money and bought a lot of companies. Like they're selling way more hardware than rockets. Like, you know, they have their reaction control wheels. Like I they have a massive contract on that. Like they're just selling, you know, dozens and hundreds of them, sort of thing. So like I think they did it better. Whereas Astra, only bought Apollo Fusion. And then it's hard to say that, like, essentially if Apollo Fusion is their entire business, then like just spin it back out and shut down the rest of it. Yeah, like what's the point? You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it just seems so, especially for a rocket company that launches as often as they do. I know they want to launch more, but like you just cannot have your stock price that volatile. Like they almost have to shut down trading during a launch day, because it's just like shoots up 40% and then drops 90% because on the call out, they're like, oh, we're seeing some weird telemetry, and then, oh no, everything's fine, and then back up. But you know, like it's way too crazy for you. It'd be like, you know, if you had like some retail company, like imagine if Amazon had like a stock price, like they had visibility to like live sales, like to the second, like, oh yeah, we're down to, we're below the line on sales per minute. Boom, stock price. Tell me, oh, we got someone bought a barbecue.
Three servers are down. Like, oh, sell it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you can't have that kind of visibility into the day-to-day operations, and you can't concentrate it so much in one thing, one event, which is like the only activity your company does for a quarter. Yeah. Like, it's crazy, right?
It's also even more irrational though than you're saying, because I remember Virgin Orbit a year ago or something took a launcher one down like to Times Square or whatever, and their stock went way up, and then they had a successful launch and it went way down. And it's like, you know, the irrationality of people seeing hype and thinking about it and not understanding what actually is going on with this company. It's like, it doesn't. And that makes me even more concerned for, like, Intuitive Machines is now doing a SPAC, which I can only assess is what you just said, Ben, that like they've run out of the ability to get more money infused to them by the sources that they have at this point, and they need, you know, $300 million of cash to finish off a couple of landers or something like that. Like, I don't have a more charitable way of looking at a commercial moon lander company that thinks that's a good fit in the public market.
It's hard to tell from the outside. I don't have any details of them. I actually, funnily, sort of Intuitive Machines exists because of Armadillo. The Project Morpheus, we infected a bunch of NASA JSC people with commercial space, you know, behaviors. Like, we showed them that you can like build hardware and do cool stuff sort of thing. And so a bunch of the Project Morpheus people quit and started Intuitive Machines. So like the core group of Intuitive Machines is ex-Morpheus people. And they're still using some of the same technology of like film cooled, you know, LOX methane engines that are, you know, the feedback to Morpheus. So, and then actually we also worked with them a bit at Moon Express, and they ended up suing and ended up owning part of Moon Express, which didn't really work out for them, but I'm sure it's still on their balance sheet somewhere.
If only Agile was so lucky for owning part of Maston. Hey baby, Maston, big things for Pittsburgh. That's all I've got to say. What do you make of that, of the Maston situation, knowing where you started with it and what was on the roadmap, and then them pivoting into this, you know, commercial lunar company? And
I think
burst is what did it to him.
There's a lot of backstory there that, hopefully that'll be a book at some point. Cause I've heard some little bits and pieces of the background of how that whole process worked out, and it's kind of amazing. But, I think for me, part of it is that they're, like, they had a working business, like, it's a small business, like, it wasn't ever going to, you know, IPO, but business doing V2VL testbed stuff of, like, when JPL wants to try something, or when some, you know, someone wants to do plume impingement testing or anything like that, like, there was Maston Space, and they could do that stuff. Like, they essentially had cornered the V2VL and rocket testing and, you know, doing plucky stuff with a rocket engine in the desert sort of thing. And so that was a real business, and I think that has some value to it, but essentially Astrobotic, essentially, the way that pricing worked out essentially suggested that was a negative value, and that they, you know, they got a SpaceX credit, which was, you know, the numbers better, but it was what, like $7 million of launch credit,
and
they bought, and they bought for a few million dollars, basically. So essentially, like, they bought a discount on a launch, and for free they got
the entirety of a spot in Mojave and your old parking spot at the dirt lot where you would park your van, and
and zombie with Christmas lights on it. Yeah,
an old trash can lid. They're like, what the hell am I supposed to do with this thing?
I mean, I hope I saw that Dave is still there, so I'm hoping that it means that you know, the doing cool stuff with rockets in the desert stuff will continue. That would be great. Yeah, I don't know if they plan to, if any of the actual like vehicle stuff, you know, Moonlander stuff carries over, or if it's just like the Astrobotic stuff is going to be the Moonlander stuff, and then, you know, Maston does its own separate thing, or
that's
how
a sense
that works
that I
out.
Get. I mean, my concern is the acquisition thing, right? You got 2 years to act like everything's normal, and then we'll shut down the thing that you had going on. Mm-hmm. Like, I could see that being the case. But
that would be a bummer.
It depends so much on. It could be the case too, though, that, like, you know, Astrobotic, you know, maybe Peregrine doesn't make it to the lunar surface on the first mission. They've got a long stretch of time between that and Griffin. They need, you know, much in the way that Astra needs an Apollo fusion to show, like, we're still doing stuff. Maybe that's what they lean on in that downtime, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, they've. I don't know how big Astrobotic is, but there's a lot of companies that do the SBIRs and that sort of thing to be able to keep some money coming in and work on the things that they want to work on. It's kind of a trap because, like, you know, it's never a lot of money, but, you know, it funds some of your development. And ideally you get to do something you plan to do anyway and not like, oh, I'm going to go do some completely random thing that some DARPA project manager wants done sort of thing. But yeah.
yeah. Well, we're closing in here, Anthony. I'm happy with the good Moon Express stuff. I think I got the stories I was looking for. Did you get the stories you were looking for?
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's some good stories, man. I mean, it's such an interesting era that you have this insight on, right? Uh-huh. From the companies that it's just like still hard to pin down some aspects of that era of space, especially like you're talking about the early days of Mojave, like what the hell was going on out there? And then you try to like learn lessons from how people were feeling about it at that time to now, right? Same way that people talk about the telecom industry in the 90s and all the hopefulness of Iridium and everyone else that was building these like crazy constellations. And here we go again. Like, how is this time? Can we learn from it? Can we do it different this time? And I feel like there's a little of that with the wacky Mojave stuff that was going on back in the day.
Yeah.
Trying to cram 10 years of stories into an hour is probably too much. Probably should have focused on just the parts that you wanted, like just Moonix shit talking just for an hour. But
say that for the off-nominal meetup. That's better fodder for that anyway.
when we finally do off-nominal Berlin, we'll come. We'll drag
visit,
you out
visit
and get
the
all
tank excellent. And hang out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go Man, to that's the, a great go idea, the, by the way, Jake. That's a fantastic idea.
Well, we can go to the birthplace of Small Launch and go up to Penamunde, right?
So I've been there. The museum is fantastic. Yeah.
There's quite a cool museum there. I would love to go visit it. So yeah.
It's really good. Yeah.
Ben, people need to follow you on Twitter. We didn't even talk about your Twitter at all.
I'm Wicket, WIKKIT. I feel like I post a lot less and less snarky than I used to, but I always wonder, like, I don't know, Astra kind of beat me out of it because they were all stealth mode and shit, and I got out of the habit of, like, talking about things, so I should probably get back into the habit of having more fun with it because, like, it's Twitter. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't know.
You had some good ones recently. You had one of my favorite hurricane-related tweets that I need to find real quick because it was fantastic.
Hurricane
Ian tweets.
Everyone's just gonna know what that was.
Yeah.
Should we do some background music while you're?
No. Jake, are you working on anything?
Am I working?
I found it.
You found it. Okay, great.
Three guys at Fort Myers Beach searching the storm scene. Says two why women generally outlive men. Two of them got washed away into the pilings. Then they all left, and the camera feed died. I just love this screenshot, you know, especially with the pierside grill upper left bug and these three guys just doing some Florida man.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. And someone replied to me because it's Twitter and we're like, men doing adventurous things is like the basis for all advancement in humanity. It's like,
You found that side of Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why you don't tweet so much. So at least you're you know,
luckily it's Twitter and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Jake, you got something going on over there?
You're going to hear about this in a week as well that I'm working on this, but, I'm trying to get a good show on Voyager done. So, there's been some interesting stuff with the Voyager spacecraft. They added two control, acted up in a really bizarre way. And the engineering, anomalies from Voyager are getting weirder and weirder as this spacecraft ages into its, you know, radiation sunset. So I don't know if it's like if it's gonna get any more normal. But so I wanted to tell a little bit of story about it, and I have never done a Voyager episode, so I wanted to explore it a bit. So it should be coming out soon.
Sounds great,
man.
Yeah.
Well, I've got an Astrobotic spectacular for everybody.
There's yes, you do.
A 2 hour, 2 minute, and 20 second episode of Main Engine Cutoff that is out this week. It's four, five different conversations with people from Astrobotic. Ben loves hearing about Pittsburgh. He loves Pittsburgh. He can't say enough good things about Pittsburgh. And
I've heard it's great.
It's his up and coming city of choice. That's where actually, if Berlin denies him the visa, he's getting one at Pittsburgh. True. You do need a visa to live in Pittsburgh. Yeah, you do need one of those.
I'm sure it's very competitive.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than that. But enjoy it. It's good. I think it's, I don't know, man. Eric Berger and I were comparing notes on Astrobotic and Intuitive Machines, and I feel better about Astrobotic, and he feels better about Intuitive Machines. And I realized
he's from Houston, so he's biased.
We're just rooting for local space companies. Like, that's purely what it is. It's like we're just rooting for our sports team. So we'll see. We'll see. But maybe this is your next spot, Ben. Could be.
Maybe. They have interesting challenges.
They need engines.
Astrobotic.
They need engines. So.
They do need engines, yes. As we discussed.
All right, everybody. Oh, next week. What are we doing next week, Jake?
So next week we have an interesting schedule. What do you want to call this?
Experiment.
Trial.
Experiment.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So
we needed a way to get Australians on this podcast. We're not going to do that first thing with Australian.
No, we wanted to. The time zone does not work out for Australia and that part of Asia. Like that strip of Earth, that longitude of Earth, like really struggles with our time slot. So we wanted to experiment with pre-recording episodes. And one of our friends, Elizabeth Howell, who just wrote a book, we wanted to get her on the show. And she also had schedule constraints, not because she was in Australia, but just because of other reasons and couldn't make the show. So we said, this is our chance. We're going to pre-record an episode. So next week, it will be at the same time. It's going to come out and you'll be able to watch the hour. It just won't be live. So it'll be something different. You know, tell us what you think about it. Should be good. It's a great episode. We had a lot of fun recording it.
We did.
And
talked about weird space medicine stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So it's coming.
Should be fun. Yeah.
Lots of gross stuff.
Lots of gross stuff. It was a pretty gross show. Anyway, Ben, thanks for hanging out. You're awesome.
Thank you.
Everyone else, we'll see you soon.
Bye, everybody.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.